Good afternoon, and welcome to today's Fireside Chat, focusing on the SEC Office of the Chairman and broadcast by the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society on www.sechistorical.org. I'm Teresa Gabaldon, Lyle T. Alverson Professor of Law at the George Washington University School of Law and moderator for the program. The SEC Historical Society preserves and shares the history of financial regulation through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. The museum is free and accessible worldwide at all times. The museum and archive, as well as the Society, are separate from and independent of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and receive no government funding. We thank the many institutions and individuals whose gifts and grants make possible the growth and outreach of the virtual museum and archive to over 9,000 visitors each month. Since November 2007, as part of the Society's commemoration of the SEC's 75th anniversary in 2009, the Society has broadcast and preserved in the museum a series of programs looking at some of the major divisions and offices of the SEC. Today's program on the SEC Office of the Chairman is the last in that series. I'm very pleased to welcome Peter Derby of the Consinity Group, who worked with SEC Chairman William Donaldson earlier this decade, as well as Leonard Lyman of Fulbright & Jaworski, LLP, who worked with SEC Chairman Manuel Cohen in the 1960s. Their remarks today are solely their own and are not representative of those of the Society. They cannot give legal or investment advice. Our look today at the SEC Office of the Chairman has an unusual focus. There is a great deal of information about SEC chairmen and commissioners in the museum collections, including the only known oral history interview conducted by Manuel Cohen and an interview done several years ago by Mary Shapiro, the current SEC chairman. But there are only a few materials currently in the museum on the work behind the scenes by the dedicated staff in the chairman's office. Here, though, I will note the oral history interview with David Ratner, who also worked with Chairman Cohen and who may have a different viewpoint than the one Leonard will discuss today, and the papers of Molly Zion, who began working with Mr. Cohen when he joined the SEC in the mid-1950s and stayed with him throughout his chairmanship. Today's program is an opportunity to add context to the collections on the work of the SEC Office of the Chairman, particularly focusing on the 1960s and early 2000s. Leonard and Peter, welcome. Now, Peter, notwithstanding our primary focus, I understand that you've heard a story or two about the early days of the office. Might you be willing to share a bit of background on the work of the office up to the 1960s before the two of you begin to compare and contrast your own experiences?
Certainly. Well, thank you, Teresa, and thank you to Carla and the SEC Historic Society for inviting me here today to be with Leonard Lyman to talk about the office of the chairman. I did learn numerous things about from the founding of the SEC to the changes in the 40s and 50s that have affected the agency right through today. Largely that the commission started where all five commissioners would really work together to decide everything. There's three functions. There's the legislative rulemaking, the adjudication judging, and the organization administrative functions. And they would do that collaboratively all through that time. But through the Hoover Commission, that was they had the Commission on Organization of Executive Branch, and out of that came a reorganization plan of 1949 and June 20th of 1949, and what we call Reorganization Plan 10, which had split up the role of the commissioners, where the appointment of the president by the president is now of the chairman, and the administrative operating role is granted to the chairman of the commission. So that brought about stories of how those different chairmen utilized Reorg Plan 10 to move forward to make the agency more efficient and effective over time. Truman took the Hoover Commission and actually implemented it. There were other Reorg 10s. It was interesting. Number 9 is the Defense Department, the Secretary of Defense. Number 11 is the FCC, which, by the way, the Senate disapproved its final version, so that did not go through. But Reorg 10 in March 13th of 1950 was passed and functions to this day.
Well, thank you. We're going to take a little jump then up to the space age And I'd like you to each take a minute to tell us a little bit about your personal history with the Office of the Chair. Leonard, could you get us started?
Yes, let me first share Peter's sentiments about how nice it is to be here with you
and
participate in this occasion. I met Manny originally when Manny was chief counsel to the Division of Corporation Finance, and I was a young lawyer practicing in New York. He was remarkably accessible to people who had questions, if there were challenging questions at least. He was not too tolerant of fools, but he was very helpful to the bar. And it was not until some years later when Manny became chairman, he decided that he wanted an executive assistant, it was called, who was more conversant with Wall Street than he was, since he had spent his entire life, adult working life at least, at the Securities and Exchange Commission. One of my partners, Howard McMorris, and Milton Kroll, a Washington lawyer who had worked at the SEC with Manny, both knew me and knew Manny and suggested that I would be a good choice, and I recruited him first and me second, brought me down there, and it was a terrific first meeting, and we shook hands then, and not too long after that, within a couple of months, I think it was, I was in Washington beginning work with Manny.
And Peter, how did you come to work in the office?
Chairman? Well, I had met Bill Donaldson on Wall Street, actually my future sister-in-law at that time was not, had worked for DLJ. But I really got to know him in Moscow, actually. I was in Russia, and the New York Stock Exchange had arrived, I think it was June of 1990, and here came with the delegation, and I was the token American businessman trying to do something from the ground up there. Started the first private bank and first investment firm, investment banking, mutual funds, and so on in Russia at the time starting, and so we met there. Stayed in contact through the years. DLJ was involved in one of the first offerings of an IPO, Vimpelcom, which is a telecom IPO that they did. So we stayed in contact through that time. And when it was time for me to come back to the States and to consider selling the things that I've created there, DLJ and Bill personally was very much helpful to sharing their knowledge and experience about the different techniques and approaches that I should take. In the end, I did leave it to the staff and did not take pretty large sums offered by Western firms, but and it proved to be, I think, in the long run, the right thing. But we stayed in contact. And then in the 2002, I saw Bill again at a cordial event, and he was expressing his dismay after 50 years in this industry of what had happened for all the corporate malfeasance. And I was expressing my dismay of having people from Russia call me and say, so you came with your Russian traditions, because I grew up in a Russian home here in the States, Russian background, but American values. And your American values that you so prophesized here and helped embed in some of the structures in Russia turned out to be not so great in the end. So we were both in that realm of discussion, and several months later, he had called and told me about the president's decision to have him be considered for chairman, and we spoke at that point and asked me to come down, only for 6 weeks at first, actually, to help put together a plan and to how we're going to move forward or how he would otherwise think about moving forward. And through that time, he asked me to stay on.
One of the things I'll be interested in asking about a bit later is, in general, how the chairman goes about making staffing decisions and what the rates of turnover are and so forth. But I'd like to get in a little more background about the office itself first. Leonard, could you tell us a bit about how the Office of the Chairman was organized when the chairman was Manny Cohen?
It's very easy to answer that because there was a minimum of organization. There was the chairman, and everything funneled through the chairman's office. We had, there were of course operating divisions at the commission, and a few staff offices, personnel, budget controller. They were combined, but very few of those. And then there was the commission, but everything came in through the chairman, routine or otherwise. The chairman had his executive assistant, which was not a line position at all. I worked for him and nobody else on the commission's organization chart. Some lists showed me there kind of floating underneath the chairman's name or under the commission's name. I didn't belong with the divisions, and I didn't belong with the commissions. I was just there in the middle. And we had one or two legal assistants in the office as well, and that was it. I don't remember, it may have happened, but I do not remember ever looking at any organizational bylaw or document saying what the chairman's office did or what the chairman's executive assistant was supposed to do. I did what the chairman wanted out of me, and if he didn't tell me, I used my imagination to find things to do, and that's the way we were organized.
So you'd say that the tasks were not set out in writing or particularly defined, but you knew what you had to do and got it done.
Well, it's, you know, obviously I exaggerated when I did that, but because there were some routine things. For example, congressional correspondence could be difficult because Senator Robertson, head of the Commerce Committee, he had wonderful lines into the SEC somewhere because he knew what was going on inside the agency, and he might write two or three page questioning letters about why something was going the way it did. Well, those correspondences had to be assigned out to people to draft answers, and we had to know they had to know if another division was involved, that they initialed the draft that came back to the chairman's office. And what I did in the first weeks was really set up a system for handling correspondence. And that was not an awful lot of time, but it was something that I did create a routine for. And there were all these documents flowing through, a lot of them routine and had to be looked at. I divided some of the responsibilities up with Manny because he knew a lot more about them than I did and could do it faster. But there was a lot of routine work that went through, and I mean quite literally that when he didn't assign special things for me, I did have enormous freedom to poke myself into whatever corner I thought needed attention or interested me.
Peter, does that sound any different than the office as you experienced it?
Well, a little bit in its emphasis maybe in structure, but a lot of things seem to evolve or repeat itself. I still remember, and everyone remembers this phrase that William O. Douglas said, that the SEC is the investor's advocate. That has transcended decades. He then said, and we have it in our strategic plan and highlighted, you know, to satisfy the demands of investors, there must be in this great marketplace not only efficient service, but also fair play and simple honesty. For none of us can afford to forget that this great market can survive and flourish only by the grace of investors. So even at its core, it still transcends decades what our intentions are. The organization itself, the size, the volume of work, and the growth of the industry has had certain challenges. Politics has played a role at times. When we arrived, there was great corporate malfeasance. There was very low morale at the staff. We were there to right the ship. And to do so was also to create an efficient and effectively run agency and to take all the responsibilities of the chairman's office, all three of those responsibilities, main ones, at heart, and to reorganize and restructure the agency. You were asking about people. I think Bill hired five people at first, which isn't a whole lot. One was, and it was with the commission's, all of them were with the commission's approval. The PCAOB chairman was a very important human resource process that all the commission was involved together. Bringing in the chief accountant, Don Nicolaisen, was another one, especially at the time it was very sensitive. We were very much discouraged to go to the industry since the industry run afoul so much. And Chairman Donaldson looked straight into the eye of those criticism and said, find me someone from the industry that is impeccable. Right into the eyes of the controversy of what we weren't supposed to do. And we were going to find and reestablish the core there. And he found a great gentleman by the name of Don Nicolaisen to do that. And then the office around him, the role of chief of staff, works fine in a legislative process. But when you have more than that, it seems that the chief of staff's desires, interest, role, usually legal background, focuses on policy creation. That's everything that the commission decides, everything that comes up to the commission. But how it gets implemented is left to however it happens. And it's an architect doing a drawing, and the process of drawing is very interesting, but how it gets built sometimes has very real ramifications. And Bill felt very strongly the responsibility of the chief executive officer, which is why in the first days he asked for an audited financial statement of the SEC, of which I found out to my shock and dismay is that there never had been one, no audit done of the SEC in its entire history of 70 years plus. And so he said, great, we're going to have the audit done, so let's get going on that to do that. And there was the CFO Act in Congress for the large agencies that gave us some teeth and momentum to actually accomplish that, and the agency did within 18 months complete its first audit ever in its history. So there were items that when we arrived needed to be handled immediately, and we looked at them as to how from the chairman's office to set an example of things to run the agency efficiently, effectively. And lastly, he had, as I said, walked in where there was a really low staff morale, but without significantly changing the staff itself by any means. There's only five hires, three in his office, the rest were from internal, and the two outs, one chief accountant and one outside hire. He was able to raise the morale of the agency. At the first SEC Speaks a week later, he stood up and asked everyone in the room that was an employee of the agency to stand up and to be applauded. He felt very strongly about the quality of the agency that he's experienced in his 50-year career. He worked with the agency for many years, had a high, high regard for the professionalism, and walked in believing that that was still there. And all it needed to do was to be unbridled and supported and rise up. And I think it did, because when he did leave in his last day on June 30th, the auditorium had a 10-minute standing ovation for him. So, and it was, by and large, most of the same people at the time.
Was morale the same sort of challenge during your years with the commission, Leonard?
No, I don't think it was, because Manny became chairman after Bill Carey, a Columbia professor who really started the job of reviving a not moribund commission, but certainly one that was in a decline over the Truman and Eisenhower years. Probably some years before that. The commission really didn't do an awful lot after 1940. Carey really did a terrific job as chairman, and he accomplished two things, among a lot of others, but two important things was to create and virtually complete the special study of the securities markets, which was a big task force studying the way the markets worked, and they were not working perfectly by a long shot. And that plus some extra work resulted in the Securities Exchange Act amendments of 1964, which was signed on the day that he became chairman. Those two things laid out a blueprint for Manny's work, but they were accomplished during Kerry's administration. And I would say that morale under Kerry was really quite good. The special study particularly brought in some wonderful people to work with the commission. Many of them stayed on, so that the employment, I don't know if it was enlarged, but it was, I think, enriched by the special study experience. And the job it created for Manny was, or the goals that for him to fulfill were there for him, and he embraced them with all his energy and skill.
Yeah. It sounds like there was a contrast in morale, but certainly a similarity as far as the theme of investor protection. Other than those two things, do you two feel as though you worked for the same agency, or was it different?
I couldn't help thinking, listening to Peter and the changes that Chairman Donaldson effected. When I went back and looked at the SEC's annual report in 64 to 66, you had the divisions, as I said, you had the divisions, and then you had a straight line with just a few boxes up to the chairman, with me floating around in there, but I didn't really have a position. I looked at the 2003 or 4 annual report, and the chart has about a dozen boxes in between the operating divisions and the and the commission, and even the chairman's position in the commission has a box for the office of the chairman. We didn't have an office of the chairman. In fact, there was no important distinction. There was no administrative person between the divisions and the commission. There was no executive officer or chief or whatever it might be called, who was in charge of administration. They all separately funneled up into the chairman's office. Now, why the big difference? I will offer something, Peter. Let me try that. Manny Cohn's education was college and law school, and his longest employment was at the SEC, working his way up from raw lawyer right up through the Division of Corporation Finance to a commissionership and then a chairmanship. Compare that with Bill Donaldson, who's an MBA, who before he gets to the commission has so many business accomplishments, you can't begin to list them, but certainly chairman of a major, chief executive of a major investment banking firm, corporate experience. To him, administration was what makes things work, and that was where his interests were, and he really used those skills to accomplish what he wanted to accomplish. Manny, I think the problems he was facing were really quite different. So I don't think his lack of business school skills hurt his effectiveness, but he certainly didn't have them, and I don't think he could have coped with an organization structure like the one that you worked with and helped create.
Well, we already had a lot of offices, 19 divisions and offices in total when we arrived, so there was some structure there. There was a view that a lot of the legal work was really interesting and dynamic, but people would get promoted to management for the extra couple of percent compensation and really leave what they really loved to do the most, and they weren't all great at management. They were great at the law. And so we had to deal with that structural incentives or disincentives to an efficiently run agency. And as I said in the chairman's office, when we came in, we just asked the previous chief of staff and talked to the one previous and said, what do you do? They wrote down everything they did. 99% had to focus on policy creation, rulemaking. That's what they were there for. That's what the division directors were telling us they were there for. They would have assistant or associate directors that would deal with the after effect, the processing, the implementation of the policy. Bill Donaldson's a cradle-to-grave kind of person. He feels accountability, responsibility across it, and his experience allowed him to understand the operational part. So he took the chief of staff's position and said, one person can't get everything done, especially with the plate that we were handed at the time, full of issues that had to be really addressed. At that time, there was, did corporate finance properly look at all of the filings, because Enron and Global Crossing, and what were the issues? When was the last reviews and things? So he took it and said, we're going to create an individual who is a legal person who's going to take all the policy issues up to the commission. That'll be their focus. We're going to have an operations management person follow after the decision how it actually gets implemented, whether the agency is using its resources efficiently, effectively, and implementation of it, consistency and application, making sure that the implementation of policy and the policy creators agree that it's happening coordinated. We have that issue always with our examination program, where the examiners and the rulemakers believe that they are in agreement to the violations or not. And thirdly, to communications. And it was important to have internal communications as well as to external parts of government. And that the communication person was there from the beginning, that made it clear on how we would focus on issues, almost a collaborative way. You know, Steve Jobs had his engineers and marketing and designers all in one room, not this conveyor belt process where you start out with trying to build something round and you end up being square or something. So we pulled all those three disciplines. We felt that was key to having a chief of staff role, but put it into people who can actually partake in it and engage the staff and getting the work done in ways to communicate. Some of it was based on the chairman's ability to process, decide, put things on the agenda, and so on. And I think Patrick Von Bargen, who was our policy person, was fantastic. He was actually, speak about how he came in. He was Bill's first, graduated Bill's first student out of the business school in Yale, but he was a Stanford lawyer who then decided to get an MBA. And Laura Cox was from Treasury and Communications and close to the administration, since some of the C schedules are really White House appointments as well. So there's the politics.
Well, I put emphasis on the difference between the two chairmen, but there was also a huge difference in the commission itself. Your commission was probably three times the size of the commission, and we were maybe 1,400 total employees, I think, and you were probably three times that amount. The prehistoric times of the 60s, we got the first computer during that period that the commission ever had. I think it came in 1965. There were no personal computers in those days. It was probably a mini computer as tall as this room. We, as I said, came in after the special study and the amendments, but we didn't have the ghastly corporate problems that were there when you got there. So you had a lot more people at the commission, a lot of very complex problems to deal with. We had a statute that required a lot of implementation and lots of registration of companies that never had been required to register before. But that was done pretty much with the same simple system that had worked before, where the operating divisions did what they were supposed to do. One big difference that I think was a good difference was that we didn't have a separate enforcement division. You may have needed one, I don't know, but we didn't have a separate enforcement division. Each operating division had their own enforcement people, and I think that worked better than the enforcement division would have. But the overall complexity of what you had to deal with certainly justified the emphasis on making sure that the administration worked effectively, because you do not learn administration in law school.
And the structure issues are important. There's inherent conflicts. And this will be a constant. You know, should OCB disbanded and put into back into the examination of the rulemaking process? Should enforcement be disbanded and put back into the enforcement of that same rulemaking and inspection process? There are inherent conflicts in doing so, depending on how each division is run and how you deal with those. There's also tool sets, efficient tool sets. If you focus on enforcement, whether having a separate division provides that efficiency. And we see that in risk assessment. I mean, Bill Donaldson brought in some important aspects to the internal operation. Risk assessment was one of the key offices that were added, task forces that were started. At the same time, as you said, we had a lot of issues on the table. We had a deregulatory process of the late 1990s, Graham Leach Bliley, Glass-Steagall going away, and then we had a re-regulatory process, Sarbanes-Oxley, happened within 3 years, and all of that had no rules around it, not the first nor the second, and we were in a position where they had to be worked on or completed. They might have been started ways, but they were not all accepted. So there was a lot of rulemaking that needed to be done and to deal with some of the conflicts and some of the politics at the same time. And then we had malfeasance, corporate malfeasance, mutual fund timing cases, changing of with the New York Stock Exchange and the national market system, hedge fund registration that we felt we needed to get our hands around, these large pools of capital to just understand how much of it, who it is, without getting into some of the other issues that were raised about their proprietary trading strategies. The Risk Assessment Office created its first task force within months of opening called the Credit Derivative Task Force. It was done after we opened by going to New York, meeting with the five most senior credit senior risk officers of the investment firms and commercial banks that had investment arms, and asking them what is their one nightmare scenario. When all five said credit derivatives, it was very clear our first task force was credit derivatives. So had that sustained past Chairman Donaldson, maybe Chairman Cox would have seen this problem earlier than disbanding the office down to one person. So there were structural issues, the size, the budget, the hiring, the volume under Sarbanes-Oxley, rulemaking under Sarbanes-Oxley, corporate malfeasance, mutual fund industry issues. So we had to deal with all those different things.
Just to embellish the differences a little bit, we did get that first computer, but that was all we had. There were no derivatives in those days. Derivatives were gambling, and there were gambling laws in the state. The differences are just in every direction. For example, I was at a meeting it was the Office of Policy Planning, it was called. It was a quite interesting office that we had. And we were talking about problems in the marketplace. And I just mentioned the phrase hedge fund. And the heads snapped around and they said, "What's that? Hedge fund? What's a hedge fund?" They had never, in this 1965, I suppose, they had never heard of a hedge fund. There existed, but the size and complexity of the hedge funds and power of the hedge funds only came after a lot of rule changes made it possible for them to be bigger and better financed. So it was simpler days. It's not that we were without our problems, but there were different problems, and I think they were much less complex, more fighting with the New York Stock Exchange that was not too different from what Bill Douglas was fighting about in 1936.
And you've certainly described sort of strong chairmanship in each case in responding to the challenges of the day. I'm curious about how much autonomy the chair has in restructuring the agency, making the decisions, the staffing decisions, and so forth. I'm curious, too, about whether it was the chairman's call to buy that first computer.
I really don't know. But I'm sure he would have taken credit for it because it sounded like a good idea. Now, on organization, one of the more interesting things that, that Manny did that I've always admired him for, investment companies, mutual funds, were really in their infancy. I think total assets in investment companies was maybe $40 billion. We're now in the trillions and multiple trillions. But he could see it increasing, and the Division of Corporate Regulation that had jurisdiction over the, over that that function was a little bit understaffed because the Division of Corporation Finance was the largest and most admired division, and many thought that they really had to be brought ready to be to handle a much bigger investment company community. So the way he did that was by having the commission change the 1933 Act registration requirements from the Division of Corporation Finance, which was the 33 Act function, even for investment companies, was done by the Division of Corporation Finance, transfer that function to corporate regulation, which meant he could move people over to staff that function, and he could cherry-pick the people who he moved over. And in typical Manny Cohen ways, we had a program to identify the people that we wanted to encourage to make that move. And since I was, I did a lot of work with younger people at the commission, I was more accessible to them. So they would come and visit me early in the morning and we would talk about problems. And I had a pretty good feel for the younger people and Manny for the more mature ones. And we really made made the move, not just a move of function, but a move that transformed, I think, the that division and made it able to handle a huge increase that came over the next dozen years.
I think in Bill's case, I mean, you go back to Reorg 10, and actually the government reorganized itself in 1939, 1945. This was the 49 Act already. It always wanted to kind of improve the function of government agencies in Reorg 10. But it does give the chairman quite a bit of a leeway to organize the agency. I think in Bill's approach, he tried to bring in really sensible things. I mean, like, to create dashboards for people to understand and help them manage themselves. Even in the office of the chairman, he reorganized it to try to penetrate the bureaucracy, break down the silos, have sensible people, even in his office, that weren't bossing around, but were creating an environment of supportive environment to help them achieve what they wanted. I know in my first 6 weeks, I went and met with all 19 and asked them, what are their 3, 5, 10 things that they would do if they were free to do any of it? And wrote them all down. And when we started to move forward, we took 1 through 3 for each of the divisions and offices to get them all moving. So we were running on all cylinders, moving forward and energize them. Clearly, when we got down to the 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th thing that some of them wanted a year later, I guess they must have been the harder ones because we did get a lot of pushback from the things that were suggested by the leadership of these offices themselves. So that's an interesting aspect in managing within the agency when people are truly free to think about what it is they want to do, and then when they understand the difficulty within the bureaucracy of actually accomplishing it, how quickly they fade in their interest to do it. But there were important things. I mean, even on simple things, we were considered the most secretive agency. We had more, actually after the NSA, we had more FOIA requests than anyone after NSA. That's considered more secretive as the press would like to take it. Not everyone would consider FOIA purely a secretive aspect, but the press would state it that way. And there were simple things to rectify those decisions, but you needed to go through a process to do that. We brought in technology. We went to agencies that had no name on their door to ask them just for some of their toys, not all their toys, but just a couple, artificial intelligence, text recognition. They had video, voice, and text, context recognition, not just word search. But if you're searching and as someone in the enforcement division and you put in Bill Donaldson, you get 2 million pages of information. Then as you start reading them, so mutual funds, so it starts to bring it down to mutual funds, and then it brings it down to particular mutual fund timing. It allowed for efficiency to be brought in. We brought in electronic document scanning, brought in computer technologies for dual screens. Lawyers love to hold their papers and don't want to give them up. So we were allowed to, after they scan them, to be able to have them, but we would try to bring efficiencies in processing this information. I think Enron took 58 weeks or 56 weeks to go through with the efficiencies and using the best technologies. That was able to be cut down to 8 weeks or so if it was to be done again. So those are the kind of additional tools we were trying to bring in. But the main thing was to try to penetrate the bureaucracy, bring about collaboration, get rid of the stovepipes, allow to have the staff be supported and invigorated and empowered to do what they came here to do. They could have great jobs elsewhere, even for more pay. They came for a purpose, and to allow them to realize their intentions of being here.
I realize, listening to you, not interesting material, that both you and I spoke about the chairman doing things. In Manny Cohn's case, he had what I would call a quite docile set of commissioners. It was Barney Woodside, who was a former director of the Division of Corporation Finance, an old friend of Manny's, very devoted to Manny, which became important during Manny's tenure. Hard worker, but if he disagreed with Manny, it was done very, very privately. We had Hugh Owens, who was a Democrat, Oklahoma, former Oklahoma Securities Administrator. He was interested in preventing any preemption of state regulation and really didn't have much beyond that to be interested in. Hamer Budge, a Republican, really didn't know beans about the SEC. His only interest was making sure that the small broker-dealers in Utah and places like that were not penalized any more proportionally than the larger broker-dealers who were being punished for something. And then there was Frank Wheat, who was a vigorous, intelligent, not that the others weren't intelligent, but their interests were different. Frank Wheat was energetic and wanted to do things, but Manny kept him busy doing things that didn't interfere with Manny's running of the commission. I do not remember a single vote with a dissent during my 2 years at the commission. If it happened, it was not important enough to remember. Manny worked for a consensus, and if he had to give up more than he wanted to give up, he would threaten to quit or do something terrible that would disturb the equilibrium that existed. He could do with that commission what he wanted to do, and it made things much easier. Now, I have, my question for you is, was your situation the same?
No.
I didn't think so.
it wasn't. But we approached it maybe in a holistic way. We believe that the majority should rule. We would love and do everything we could to have a unanimous decision. If it took longer to debate it, to discuss it, to get us there, that would be great. But if we were to appease everyone and the rule became, and I wasn't really in charge of rules, this was Patrick's domain, but the philosophy was if we were to cripple the rule just to get a unanimous decision, then we did a disservice to the American investors. So we tried as best to get unanimous decisions. If we had to move forward with an agenda that was very packed, was to have a 3-2. And it would differ. I mean, there would be times where Mr. Donaldson would have the Democrats supporting the view. There would be times where you have the Republicans supporting the view. But it was definitely more politicized, I've been told, our commission than in the past, and much more polarized that way. We came in with a very collaborative, collegial desire and approach, but there were agendas of different members on the commission that were very strong, and any differentiating from that, either amongst any of them themselves, there was very strong views and views towards each other at times. So that was a bit of a difference that we had to deal with, and we did move forward, though, and we did have a lot of split votes, but we dissenting opinions clearly were permitted, as it should be, and discussed. Also, since another aspect of the commission, maybe one more point, on, at least on the administrative side, is there were a lot of new laws that came in through Congress. There was the, you know, the Government Performance and Results Act of 1993, GPRA, that required certain administrative functions to occur and processes to occur. I know that Chairman Donaldson, when he arrived within the first week, it was SEC Speaks, was at the end of the week, but there was also a report, the GPRA report, that had to be submitted. And as a real analyst, and I do remember, and he's an ingrained analyst, I remember handing him once the Institutional Investor magazine, and had his, it was him on the cover and talking, it was a pretty decent article, and he has it in his hand, and he's looking very gloom, and he said, this isn't doing well. And I said, no, I think the article, we took a look, Patrick, it looks like it's pretty good. He said, no, Institutional Investor, it's not heavy anymore. And his, so his natural instinct in his subconscious is an analyst. He's a research analyst, investor analyst. And so at that time, he was given this report, and he said, this is gibberish. What is this we're sending to Congress? So we looked at it, and it was a strategic plan that was to appease Congress with fulfilling the wishes of different leaders in Congress that demanded certain things. And they wrote in there, they were gonna, with no intention to do it at all. Talk about honesty, integrity. And then the budget would finance something completely different than the actual strategic plan. So what he said is, we have to make it just straightforward. We have our strategic plan and do it for. He actually asked the Congress to delay the submission of GPRA by 6 months so we can put in the first full strategic plan. It's still on the website if anyone looks at it. And in there is specifically the vision, mission, goals of the agency, the values that it is, and then the budget aligns with the strategic plan. And it's one document with perfect alignment to achieve, and then we can debate with Congress whether they agree with it or not. But it's not there to just satisfy the bureaucracy and move on and do something else. So it was those things in the first weeks even reflected some of the changes that were just inherent to his being and understanding of the information that was passing through him. The other thing I used to say to him, how could you read so fast? I've never seen anyone. Evelyn Wood would be an apprentice to him. And he said, when you grow up in the 30s with radio and books, you learn how to read quickly. I mean, he would digest volumes and volumes of materials incredibly. And the other change I would say that was relevant by the staff coming to us in the first weeks was the chairman before us, Harvey Pitt, who was one of the youngest general counsel of the commission, knew so much about the law, the securities law, and the rules that he would also speak first. Chairman Donaldson intentionally chose to speak last to allow all the commissioners to speak and then to say something. And the staff at first said, gee, might have been just because he's not used to it and, you know, doesn't want to look poorly. But we're noticing that his contributions have always great significance, even being last. And that's just his style, just his approach. Very open, collaborative, collegial gentleman.
Yeah, the issue of possible dissent amongst the commissioners, interesting, and raises for me the question of how much input do you think the chair might have with respect to the filling of vacancies on the commission? Is that typically something that the chair might get involved with?
Well, we had no changes while I was there, but Barney Woodside retired a year or two after I left. That was a Republican vacancy. It went to a young man who was a partner of mine at the time, and he occasionally dissented. I'm not sure Manny ever forgave me for producing that, but he, Manny plainly had a veto power over that appointment. That was the relationship with the White House. I don't think he could have promoted somebody unsatisfactory to the White House and to the, obviously to the Senate, but he plainly had a veto power. That's the only one I'm aware of.
I think how's the importance of the White House in this? I think Bill's approach was it really is the president's appointment and it is the Senate's confirmation. And if there was any calls to discuss commissioners, either from the Senate committee chair or the White House, he would be involved. But it's not a role, I believe at least, that I'm aware of, that it was searching for particular individuals actively to do that. Clearly, having relations with the White House is really important, even though we are an independent agency. In our case, maybe the Naval Observatory would have been better, but relations. But still, I think having a good understanding of what it is that we're doing, a good communication of what we're doing, why we're doing, is always important. And if the ideology is so strong and so overbearing that regardless of strong communication and clear and transparent reasons, then, you know, we are an independent agency. And I think that's the process should be, where you go through the vetting of commissioners as well as the appointment of the chairman, and then you permit them to act with their best experience in mind and do the right thing.
I'm going to be asking both of you to tell us a little bit about the landmarks of the chair's office as well as the major disappointments while you were there. But I want to start this off by raising two questions contributed specifically for Peter by Michael Halloran of Kilpatrick Stockton LLP. Who asks, first, do you think the CSE program was a mistake given the failures? And second, why didn't secured funding issues become a part of the capital adequacy standard that was used for them?
Okay. Those are policy issues, so again, I'd say, you know, Patrick was here. But I do want to touch upon the CSE issue as much as I'm aware of it. I think Eric Siri, who was the director of the Division of Trading and Markets, had spoken at the National Economist Club on this particular issue, where he tried to describe the disinformation regarding what actually happened in the 2004 amendments to issues like leverage. There was more sensationalism at the beginning, and no one's gone back to retract what they have incorrectly portrayed. I guess journalists are in the habit of doing that. They just go for the kill and move on. But I think if you look at what really happened there, the CSC program, Consolidated Supervised Enterprises, we had a lot of pressure from Europe to regulate the investment firms. And there was an agreement that if they came under the SEC regulation, that Europe would respect that. There was no leverage restrictions before, otherwise somebody was regulating them, right? Instead, we strengthened and enhanced the broker-dealer subsidiaries significantly. And you can see through this entire crisis, the broker-dealer subsidiaries have been just fine. The overall leverage and what is at question here moving forward is the Basel standards, the value at risk calculations and methodologies. Those were the standards used at the time, and Basel II was the latest and greatest approach. You could criticize the agency and saying, why did you take that for granted? those standards, and why not reconsider them in ways that would have been different? So I think that this crisis will inevitably lead to those Basel Accords being reviewed, value at risk being reviewed. But the accusation that That rulemaking permitted the leverage to skyrocket on the investment firms is outright incorrect. And I think Eric's speech there describes and goes through in much more detail than I would know or be able to do here. But if anyone would be interested, you could certainly find it on the SEC government website under Eric Seary's remarks there.
Leonard, what do you think the Office of the Chair might have been most praised? Well, you've told me it wasn't called the Office of the Chair, but what do you think might have been the biggest criticisms and the highest praises for your period?
Praises of the office or the chairman?
Well, to the extent you can, I think it would be fair to say that you and Manny Cohen were the office at the time, so take a little credit for yourself.
On the praise side, when I described Manny's predominance in the affairs of the commission, it wasn't because he wanted to bully people around. It was because he really wanted the commission to be as brilliant and as important as it was in its beginning. He wanted it to be the best it could possibly be, and he devoted all his energy to that. He did it by involving himself in everything that the commission did, down to the division levels and below that. I had no trouble accepting those views and trying to make them as real as possible. I knew more younger people than Manny did, and he had complete access to the older, more established persons at the commission, and there were plenty of wonderful people there, and we worked with them to make it a well-functioning agency. That's the plus side. On the failures, that's harder. I'm tempted to say there were none, and I can't believe that that's true. I want to think about that one. Let's ask another question.
Peter, we've got just a couple of minutes. Do you think you could identify the fairest criticisms and the highest praises for the office during your tenure there?
Towards the whole office?
Yes.
Well, I think we had a great group of people there, great staff, Consuela Mack, Martha Peterson. We had really just a good group of people that were from the commission and came up from the staff in the commission. I think the criticism might be that we were everywhere and doing a lot of things. We were running on all cylinders, engaging every office, every division. That may not have always happened that way in the past. We were bringing in different technologies, different changes from having tip lines put in and other things, including, you know, with the public. So, you know, our criticism, if anything, has been all of the actions that were going on. At the same time, that being said, a lot of those really had great benefits to the agency and to the staff itself and to the different offices, whether it was then taking the risk assessment process and embedding it within their own divisions and how well it worked when that was achieved.
Leonard and Peter, thank you for sharing your insights on the work of the SEC Office of the Chairman from the 1960s to today and for adding valuable information to the collections of the Virtual Museum and Archive. Today's fireside chat can be accessed again on demand in the program section of the museum in both MP3 and transcript formats. I invite all of you to join us again on www.sechistorical.org on Thursday, June 4th, beginning at 12 noon Eastern Time, For the first time, the museum will video broadcast the Society's annual meeting live from the SEC Auditorium in Washington, D.C. The annual meeting will begin with the State of the Society address by Society President James Barrett. SEC Chairman Mary Shapiro has been invited to share her remarks. The program will also include a panel discussion on the future of the SEC, moderated by Joel Seligman, President of the University of Rochester and a well-known SEC historian. I'll be one of the professors joining the discussion with Joel, along with Lyman Johnson from Washington and Lee University, Donald Langevoort from Georgetown Law Center, Donna Nagy from the University of Indiana, and Robert Thompson from Vanderbilt University Law School. The annual meeting will be free and accessible worldwide without prior registration. It will be the final educational program the Society will present as part of its commemoration of the SEC's 75th anniversary. We hope you'll be able to join us on www.sechistorical.org on Thursday, June 4th. Thank you for being with us today.